AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hey guys, welcome to the MC Anime Podcast. We cover anime, geek culture, Japanese aesthetics, and Asian studies. We are a multi-fandom podcast, and you can expect to hear topics in your favorite hobby or fandom activity potentially. You can find MC Anime on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Also, please check out mcanimepodcast.com, our website. Furthermore, stay tuned in for another episode. We cover anime, geek culture, Japanese aesthetics, and Asian studies. We are a multi-fandom podcast, and you can expect to hear topics in your favorite hobby or fandom activity potentially. You can find MC Anime on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Also, please check out mcanimepodcast.com, our website. Furthermore, stay tuned in for another episode.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of MC Anime Podcast. MC here. I have a special guest with me today. Tell who you are, what you do, and everything about you.
My name's Steven, and I work in the hospitality field, and that's about it.
Okay. What's the basis of this topic that you really like so much that you wanted to share with the audience today?
Okay, well, Mason has wrapped me into doing 50 of these podcasts, so... apparently the topic we agreed on is airplanes, aerodynamics, and safety, and you know what is lift and drag and all that wonderful stuff. So I guess make this quick because Mason's trying my patience.
So today's episode is going to be science of flying aerodynamics. So Steven is a really good aviation fanatic that loves everything about airplanes and the science of flying. But where did
look, all I do is watch every season of Air Disasters. I'm not an expert.
Air Disasters. You basically know flying at this point, so...
Okay, whatever. I'm just going to agree to shut you up. Anyway.
Why? I agree to shut me up. Oh, come on.
Okay, well, since I'm just going to reiterate what I said on my walk this afternoon, Mason had asked the question about what is lift and drag. So let's just start there to make him happy.
But what actually about airplanes that you really like? What about watching airplane disasters that was really fascinating?
Like, what is my interest?
Yes, elaborate.
I just like the overall excitement of how you keep a heavy object airborne, I guess, and the interest of keeping it in the air. I mean, what more do you want me to say?
Okay. You're interested in the aerodynamics with the object going the force,
yes,
flying through the air. How being propelled up, going against gravity, in the sense of the travel and transportation. Okay, that's reasonable. What about
You just answered one of your questions.
About airplane crashes that made it so fascinating in the show?
I guess what's interesting about crashes is how stupid that the people flying could be, because about 90% of crashes are either mechanical failure or human failure, or nowadays, computer failure.
True. Technology is not necessarily a best friend when it comes to flying. Even though it's got better, I don't think we as a human being can still fly at the best degree, because the airplane's not going to be fully automatic. Except for autopilot, but that's it.
Based on what you just said, you're correct because of the fact a lot of people believe, especially the passengers, that because everything's turning to computers, you can remove the human factor. You are never going to be able to remove the human factor. Because I don't know about you, but I would want a living, breathing human in that cockpit, regardless of how advanced it is. If a computer fails, somebody's got to save you.
And without that saving human aspect, we want to have the transportation we have today because of the airplane itself.
Well, think about the air disaster story of Quantico's.
Yep.
It was the first of a double-decker airplane built, which can carry 525 passengers. They had just taken off from Singapore when the engine failed. And the computer that controlled the sensors went crazy. Now, if you did not have those five pilots in that cockpit, that plane would have crashed. Because a computer is incapable of predicting what is actually going wrong with that engine.
Okay. So the computer is not able to detect that the engine is failing. Engine's failed. And then the human pilot has to drive it best they can with the engine panel.
That's partially correct. The computer is tied to one of the engines, but it uses a great amount of sensors, multiple sensors. But here's the problem. If there's no human there to examine those sensors, you don't know what's wrong. So the theory nowadays that a plane can be flown by only computers is never going to happen. Minus the drones, but that's a different topic for another day.
So, that gets into what are the four basic principles in order to fly a moving object in any of
the night? Well, two of the first ones would be lift and drag, and then the appropriate, I guess you could say, machines needed to fly a plane. So you have lift, drag, flaps, spoilers. Those are your basics. Now, spoilers are meant to slow down a plane. That is the basics function. Flaps are used on takeoff and landing to slow and create lift, as you stated this afternoon. A drag is anything, simplistically wise, that is slowing a plane from gaining the lift it needs to take off. But drag has many factors. It also has the speed capability of that plane.
So we have lift, weight, drag, and what is the operation of lifting as a result in one of the basic principles?
Well, okay, lift. Imagine you're on a plane and they're running down the runway. They have passed V1. V1 is the required speed of that particular aircraft where they cannot abort the takeoff. Once they exceed the V1 speed, takeoff would be disastrous. So, okay, let's imagine you're taking off. You said you were going to Japan. You're going to have to take a plane to the port. And you're taking off, and you're going up. You got your speed. But if you're having a hard time to climb, that could be drag as well. Because there's drag and there's weight, but they work together. Because if you're too heavy, you're going to create drag. So, and then that goes into weight. Weight has three factors. The human, because let's be honest, some of us are super, super fat, and some of us are super, super skinny. But each person owns a gives to the weight distribution different. Then you have to accomplish the luggage. This is why planes and buses restrict a weight limit. It's not just because they're mean to you, it's for a safety concern. Safety concern is the more heavy your bag, the more it adds to the weight equation. Because the pilots have to calculate the weight and add that calculation, including the fuel. And if they do that equation wrong, that can immediately make the plane crash.
Ooh. And then the weight. Standard for airplane companies to ask approximate weight of the gas on the plane, or is it just approximate weight altogether?
Well, the pilots themselves, and this would be a good idea to tell anybody interested in being a pilot, you gotta be good with math. Because the pilots, or the co-pilot, have to take into account how much fuel they're taking on. So, let's take your example of, where are you taking off from your trip for Japan? Let's start there.
I'm gonna take off from Richmond International Airport.
Okay, you're taking off from Richmond. And where is the port that you're going to, I mean the airport you're going to switch over to the
probably the Tokyo Flying International.
Okay,
but
there you go.
There's probably going to be at least layover either in California, okay. Los Angeles, or San Antonio, Texas.
So, okay.
I'm going to try.
I asked that question for a reason. Now, the amount of people that are going to be on the plane with you, that's one variable in the weight calculation. Now, the next one is the luggage. How heavy is their luggage? That's a weight limit for a reason. Now, the big one that no pilot wants to mess up. How much fuel am I going to need to get to destination A to B? Because if you mess that up, you could be halfway across the journey and you're going down. And this isn't like a refueler like the military planes. Once they're out, they're out. Now, if it was a military plane, they could call in a refueler. Commercials don't have that choice.
Well, they don't have that choice because they fill up enough fuel ahead of time based on the calculations to go from point A to point B with the approximate fuel that they could need while they're flying that distance.
And the pilot has to know the right conversion tables, because you got to remember, Canadian, if you're coming from Canada, they use a different calculation system.
Well, it's so, like controversial conversion. Okay.
Decimals and then gallons. And that's also done by the people on the ground, because the pilots think they can trust the people that are filling the fuel. Well, if they don't know their right math, pilots need to catch it.
Okay.
So, and there was a disaster. I can't remember the episode that was caused by that. The refueling man mixed up, was he doing gallons or quarts? That's entirely different if anybody knows math. One can be smaller amounts and larger amounts.
There's 4 quarts in the gallon, and the gallon's a lot smaller because it's a bigger measurement.
Mm-hmm. And that means the guy that's pumping your fuel is going to look, well, that's what they told me to do. Is that necessarily his fault? But see, the pilots are supposed to look at that sheet and see if that sounds right. Because the captain has to sign off on that fuel man's sheet. They have a clipboard. And if it looks wrong, he's supposed to say, well, no, you didn't give me enough. That goes into the human factor, too. A computer is not going to do that. It's going to recognize, well, those numbers match up. Do they?
Yeah, there's not about to match up exactly, because you might lose fuel in the process of transferring it to the plane. Fuel displacement can be a factor, plus the fact that, you know, if they're measuring incorrectly the first time, then technically...
And you've got to consider the geographic, too. Canada is a good example. They're always snowing. Now, if you're sitting there on the runway because you can't take off, not only is there ice accumulating on your wings, and that's what de-icer is for, we can go in that later. But you're shooting out fuel. So that means you have to refuel, which is going to take longer. Or you risk it and hope you can get to the next destination.
Oh, true. Weight distribution is pretty important. How does the drag influence the weight of the lift?
The drag? Well, drag is something that is negative, right? Weight is always going to be influenced by drag, because the heavier you are, the slower you're going to be. And takeoff is worse, because think about it. If you can't take off, you can hit trees, buildings, light posts, electricity.
A lot go along with the plane doesn't actually go up, I think, sure. Mm-hmm. Or go down.
Well, that is what the flaps are for. The flaps help you climb, and they also help you descend. But then when you get on the runway, the pilot is supposed to hit the spoilers. Now, those are, if you ever seen a show where those things stick up from the wings when you're landing, those are the spoilers. They look like little shafts that stick up. The whole purpose of those is to slow the plane down. That's all they're doing.
And you can,
they're deceleration. Now, if you lose one of those, you only got half of the force to slow it down. Then you go to manual braking, which is not as effective as others.
For the flight.
Yeah, but you can't stop. Now, the last thing any pilot wants is to have an inoperative spoiler, because then they risk the chance of overshooting your runway.
Which would be bad.
Which is going to be bad. Yeah, if the pilot thinks he's going to overshoot, he's going to power back up and try to do a go-around. Because the last thing you want to do is overshoot a runway. Because depending on the area you're landing, Alaska's a good example. Beyond their major runway is a residential neighborhood. So there is a town at the end of the runway. Now imagine what happens if you overshoot that, if you don't have deceleration, which ties into the drag.
Look,
drag is always going to be a negative factor.
Yes.
Because the slower you are, the less speed you get, you can't climb. So all the four things you listed, they actually work interchangeably. It's like a four-part question.
Yeah, that's why the four basic principles.
Four basic principles. But when you're talking about taking off a plane, they're all working together as one. A team. Or they're supposed to. But what happens if one of those team members breaks? There's been several episodes where the pilots had a hard time slowing down because they only had one set of spoilers. They're supposed to have spoilers in both sides. Or they lose the engine in flight, and now they have less the power. Power is needed in landing, too. Because when you're landing, you have to keep a certain amount of speed before you hit that runway where you can stall. Now, if we stall, there ain't a force or anything the pilot can do to get out of that situation. So you can see why even people today say, well, the computer can solve it. After everything I just said, even if the computer can manage it, don't you think you want a human sitting in that cockpit?
At the end of time, a human is always going to have an overseer. That's the operations specialist. So regardless of how we're going to put them in that position, the operations specialist is going to be the one to take it from automatic to manual at any given time. But he gives the reason, if thrust is such important, where does the thrust reside on a plane to build both gravity and drag?
Now, I sent you a text earlier today about a flight that actually happened, and it was the Caribbean Flight 708. If you had looked that up, you would have seen that your question about the weight would have been answered in that case study. Because that plane was overweighted. So it tried to take off being too heavy, which is not going to be successful. That's just like saying a cargo plane can take off, but the cargo is not secured properly. So let me ask you this. If the cargo isn't secured properly and it goes all the way to the back during takeoff, is that plane going to be able to get lift off if all the cargo is slammed into the rear?
I'm going to put all the weight on the back.
Exactly. That's why that's like having, and I don't mean to be rude, five huge fat people that weigh over 400 and they're on one side of the plane. That's going to add to the story, but it's true.
Wow.
There's your joke.
Aerodynamic stall, unmistakable the belief that the aircraft actually suffered double engine blowout, which did not take the necessary engine to recover from the stall.
Is it?
Was it also the confusion, the lack of action that also had something?
Oh, I'm sorry.
The confusion and lack of action from the crew.
Confusion among the crew? My answer to that question would be there should never be any confusion with the flight crew. The fly crew in normal and emergency situations should be working as one mind. They have a problem, they need to figure it out real fast. Because, okay, let's say you have an engine fire. Nobody in that cockpit needs to be guessing what they need to do. They need to be working together. Because an engine fire, even in the air, can prove disastrous. On the ground, the worst thing you can have is engine fire and you can't get people out. If you've ever been on a plane and they give you those safety little cards, you need to pay attention to that. A lot of people don't. They put their headphones in, they're like, oh, I've heard this 100 times over. Like, it's the same old BS. Well, that BS will save your life.
Unless the station.
Yeah. That BS that the lady's doing and telling you about the plantation, the exits. What happens if the engine cuts fire when they're taken off in that plane? You need to know the exits because a lot of people have died in what you call a flashover. A flasher.
Flying safety 101.
Yeah, that's all they're doing when they give you that card. They know what to do. They want to make sure you know what to do. And they want to make sure that you know which seats have an emergency exit. There was a British Air Tours, and this is the one I told you about, where they're taken off and they've got an engine fire. Not everybody got off of that plane because they went into panic mode. Instead of listening to the stewardesses, they went into panic mode. Yes, one of the doors was jammed, but the other one didn't work. They all could have got off if it wasn't for the flashover. The plane was already on fire and a flashover happened. What that is the fire is racing towards the front and it went right over all the seats. Anybody in those seats burned alive. Problem is, a lot of them died in this instance because they were panicking towards the door. When you do those safety cards, you need to listen to the stewardesses or the steward. They are trained for that situation. When they tell you to do something, you do it. And the captain's going to say the same thing if there's an emergency landing. You need to listen to the crew. A lot of people die in those because they don't want to listen to the crew. They think the crew is stupid.
When that's a tragedy.
Yeah.
And if we don't listen to them, you actually make the job harder because they can't actually help you in the way they need to be adequate and provide the service to you that you paid for in the first place.
Exactly. And you need to listen to them because the very fact is, if you don't listen to them, it could cost you your life. That goes back to one of the questions you listed, safety. But safety is not just the crew. It's also checking the plane before they take off. One of the part of the captain's job is to walk the plane. Now, what that means is he's going to do a 360 walk around the whole plane. Captains should know their plane. That also defeats a point of the computer too, saying the computer knows everything. Well, let me ask you this. Does a computer understand a vibration?
Well, the computer is not going to be able to adjust to uncontrollable variables, but it's not going to necessarily have the data to deal with.
Exactly. It's not going to understand a vibration. A good captain can feel the airplane and say, it should not be doing that. Regardless of what the computer says, a good captain should be able to feel that shake is not turbulence. There's something wrong.
True.
Cannot do that.
Yeah, how about the different lights in the cockpit, meaning different things?
Well, each light is going to have its different purpose, and depending on the model of the plane, it's going to be different. I can't answer all those because a Boeing 737 is different than an Airbus 320. Airbus 320 is different than a 380. A 380 is more safer, but it's different. But one of the main ones in the cockpit is the master alarm. And then you have the stall warning. You also have the APU, which is actually a good little feature the older planes used to have. Because if the power goes out, the APU provides enough power to keep the radios on. The last thing I want to lose as a captain is the radio if I have an emergency situation. Because
believe it or not, those air traffic controllers can be mighty helpful.
That's another safety feature that as a traffic controller, giving you guidance on the situation and reporting. They have live feedback and they can also help be an additional captain if need be.
Let's say you're in the middle of, you're just taken off of Singapore and you have a hard rudder over, hard right rudder. The rudder is the little thing that twists on the plane to turn the plane. This actually happened. The problem is the plane was going across the Bering Sea. The Bering Sea has a disadvantage. It has what you call a blackout zone, meaning no radio until you get closer to Alaska. This plane had to piggyback off another one of its planes from the same company to get an emergency landing. But here's the thing, people need to realize these air traffic controllers need to prepare for the worst. So the pilot needs to get whatever communication to help with this safety feature. Because if you can't communicate, you can't really tell the air traffic controller what's actually wrong. For all they know, you just have one engine out. This plane in particular could only turn towards the left. Any try turned to the right and almost fell out of the sky. This case study, the only one reason they survived was the great pilots they had on board. These pilots stayed together. They knew what they were doing. They kept professional and they picked each other's brains to the bone to save that plane. Safety. Oh. And that's actually one of the episodes. I just can't remember which one. I think that was a Northwestern plane that did that.
Okay.
And they landed, instead of they couldn't turn back to Singapore. Because if they did, they would have to turn to right. They couldn't make their plane go to right. It was impossible. So they were already halfway across the Bering. The next closest airport was Alaska. And communication is key because you need to communicate with that controller what is actually going on. They don't know what's actually going on. For all they know, it's just an engine problem. There was a lot more wrong than an engine. They couldn't turn. And when they landed, they landed hard.
Little jerk.
Because they were going over 200 miles per hour when they landed in Alaska. The reason Alaska is very key for that plane, it has the longest running, I think it's Anchorage. Anchorage has the longest runway in that area. If your plane's in danger, you want Anchorage because you're going to have a lot of stopping room.
Speaking of Alaska, it's very cold, so the elements play a huge factor on a plane. What are the techniques to combat the weather and different associated elements that the plane can face?
That was going to be a topic for another time, but from Alaska, does have rough weather, mainly cold and snow. For planes to operate, they need what you call de-icing. De-icing is a chemical element. I don't know all about that chemical, but it can be looked up. But it's used to put on the wings to de-ice black ice and solid ice because there have been two crashes that only ice was the reason, because the ground crew could not see that even though they de-iced it, there was still a thick, heavy patch of ice. The problem with the heavy patch is the plane cannot gain enough lift. Now, the plane is capable of flying in inclement weather, but when there's too much ice, it's kind of hard to fight that, if that makes sense. Because if there's too much ice, it's going to be hard on the plane to try to fight it and get lift. In these two cases, the planes couldn't get lift and they crashed.
The ice was important back because it affects the lift and the draft.
Ice is a big factor because think about it. It's not just heavy if it builds up. It can be harmful on the wings, and too much buildup can be hard on the plane to gain lift, which was what your first question is.
Yep.
Also, landing can be tough too, because you can slide. But the planes that operate in those areas are built to combat those areas. And the companies also know that. The companies also know that.
Like, a full heat.
Okay, well, there's two kinds of ways to combat the ice. There's the de-icers, but the planes also have their own de-icer. It's a flat metal rod that, when turned on, it can help to combat melting the ice. The de-icing works in conjunction with that to try to limit the ice is there. The plane can operate with a little bit of ice, but the crashes that happen is because it built up too much. There were layers and layers of it. Too much for the de-icer to help on the plane.
Can a plane be too hot in the upper atmosphere to actually fly?
I'm sorry, what?
In the upper atmosphere, when a plane flies, can the heat of the sun play an impact on how they fly the plane?
I mean, the sun really isn't going to do much because it's just hot, but if you're on the ground in the heat, it's just going to really create uncomfortableness with the passengers. I mean, think about it. If you're sitting in a plane in the middle of one of the hottest airports and there's no air conditioning, are you going to be a happy flyer? I won't. But it's not going to impact the plane for taking off. Really, rain and cold are some of the key ones for crashes.
Gotcha. And all thunderstorm, a very dry view of electricity.
Do what?
So in the middle of a thunderstorm, planes flying, there's lightning around it. How do you prevent lightning from hitting the plane in order to navigate
well? Well, the pilots are trained to navigate storms because nobody can determine when a thunderstorm is going to develop. Now, if it was on the ground, that airport grounds all flights if there's a thunderstorm, because planes are not supposed to take off during a thunderstorm, because if they get hit, it will fry their systems. However, if they're airborne already, the only thing they can do is really find the closest airport and land. Because if you're airborne, there's not much that you can do. They're already in the storm. Yeah.
We're flying in a thunderstorm, which is the final part of the airport.
Pilots in general, if they have a proper weather report, they don't really want to fly through it, so they're going to try to fly around it. But sometimes that just doesn't work. That's why if you're flying and they say there's going to be delay, well, there's a number of reasons why there's a delay. People whine too much. They want to get from point A to point B fast. But do you want to run the risk of the plane crashing? If the pilot's going to make a deviation, there's a reason why the captain's deciding that. And they don't like to do that, but they will. But if they're going to deviate during a thunderstorm, it's because they're trying to get everybody there to the nearest airport safely. That's why diversions happen. Diversions happen because either they've been holding too long, which is circles above the airport, or the captain feels like that this would be a safer cause and go to another airport. But if there's an emergency with the plane or weather, the flight crew is going to pick the closest airport to get you everybody safely on the ground. And then if a storm happens on the ground, it happens. You're not really in the air anymore. There's no danger.
Gotcha. So with the mechanics of the plane, I've done from the point of 20 to make it able to fly with machinery to operate in a way to follow that or that run.
Okay, able to fly, and you're asking what?
I work for machinery, handle, in front of the plane to fly.
Well, the pilots are trained to fly. How they fly depends on all the conditions they're presented. On a nice time, on a perfect flight, you have sunny weather, and you got clouds, preferably white ones, and you got a peaceful flight. Unfortunately, we can't control Mother Nature now, can we? So if she decides you're flying from, I don't know, Japan to New York, and here's a thunderstorm, well, the pilots are going to have to do whatever they can to increase survivability. And, you know, I would rather have a human doing that. But thunderstorms, lightning, microburst is everything that a pilot is trained to deal with. But microburst, I'm not really trained to because they're rare. And They're just weather phenomenons that if the plane hits it right, it will be slammed completely to the ground and everybody dies in an instant. That's another podcast. We could talk about weather a different time.
Alright. So, for the machinery, what type of metal do they like to use? Or do they have a plastic?
Okay, and machinery?
Yeah.
What kind of machinery?
For the plane.
What kind of, like, technology and stuff?
Well, technology is included, but also it's the metal itself. So what's a good metal that's mostly used in the body?
Exactly. Most, if you're talking about, like, technology and stuff, most of the technology is going to be used by the crew. However, technology and the crew are quite the opposite. Most people think that we're going to get to a point where robots fly, and that's never going to happen. You're always going to need one pilot in there. A good example is the Airbus 380. It is our most advanced current plane, commercial-wise, available. And I've described that before. It has a true double-decker. You got an upstairs and a downstairs. So you can actually fly on the upstairs closer to the flight crew or on the bottom. At its fullest, you have 525 people. But what makes it safer is the ECAM. The ECAM is a, how do I put this, collection of sensors fed into a laptop or a computer. And one of the pilot's only job will be fiddle around with this computer, watching to make sure that all the sensors are saying everything's good or there's something going on. The 380 can actually fly completely to a destination on its own, and the only thing the pilot's going to need to do is land and take off and be there in the cockpit in case something goes wrong that we need a human.
Okay.
And hopefully that answers all of your questions about the four worlds.
Okay. Explain the difference between steel and aluminum. Well, which one is metal and which one is the worst?
Well, in my opinion, steel would be worse as far as takeoffs and landings because steel is heavier. And, you know, heavy is not a good thing. Aluminum is generally a thinner product, like aluminum foil. So it's not going to be tough, but it's lighter. And lighterness creates better lift because it's simpler, it's going to flow better. So it really depends on the manufacturer and how they choose to make the plane. I personally don't have a preference beyond, let's not crash.
Boo. Titanium. What does a titanium alloy do instead of a aluminum only?
I really, to be honest, I really don't know. Science was, that part of science was really not my forte.
So you think that aluminum is easier to make an alloy because it's easier to mix it as a lighter metal?
I'm just saying
titanium is more expensive as a material, so they have to use the aluminum as the alloy to make it go?
I would say both have their purposes, but as far as light as a feather, you're obviously going to pick the chemical or alloy that is more lighter, if that's the purpose you want it for. In aviation, everything has its own purpose. So not one thing can be great all around.
Okay. How about the fiberglass? What does the fiberglass on a plane allow and such and talk to? Does that have an impact?
I'm sorry, repeat the question. What?
Fiberglass. The structure of a plane. How it's designed. Where would they put fiberglass to be best suited?
That's way beyond mine because I'm not even sure what fiberglass is.
Is the material that it's easy to work with. It's usually on the viewing, like the nose and the tail, to increase the movability of the plane. It's also material that is lightweight and very sturdy.
Well, again, you know, I mean, a lightweight plane may fly better, but is it more durable?
Well, the alloy that they add could, like, for example, they use graphite, but also toughened graphite. And they, the toughened graphite on the tail specifically because more concentrated in that area by more resistance than the regular graphite. The graphite, the outer graphite is on the outer edge, but the toughened graphite is on the middle, sustaining the graphite itself.
Again, you're a little bit out of my field. I'm not familiar with manufacturing of planes. I'm familiar with their operation and how they fly, but not
the actual manufacturing. Well, the manufacturing principle is to make it lightweight but durable. At the same time, use material that's cost-effective to build a plane that's going to last multiple flights. The idea is to use material in conjunction with other stuff to have the aerodynamics to fly to the sky. Better trajectory, better less, you know, air resistance on the drag, but also combine it with the lift principle, take off, and also, you know, center and close gravity, because they're defying gravity as they fly.
Well, it sounds like you just answered your own question, because you explained that part better than I could.
All those other things that, you know, design of the plane is very important.
Well,
was there a plane crash that resulted in faulty designs?
But there's several, numerous, and recently, you could probably look this up, Boeing was criticized because a number of their doors would stop being able to latch. In fact, one popped over in flight, so design features should all be changing because, the design of a plane is very, very important, and all the pieces should work together. You should feel safe when you fly. You shouldn't be feeling immediately when you step on, oh my god, I'm going to die. But that lies on the company. If there's a fault with a set of planes, there was problems with the Boeing MAX 9. And when it was found out there was faults, Boeing grounded the entire fleet. Because they were determined to figure out what is going wrong with their plane. So that's a partial answer. The design of a plane and their faults is always going to fall on the company. But we're always improving. So, that's the best answer I can come up with.
What a way for the passenger to improve the safety of the plane.
Like, what, in the design?
No, not in the design, but how can a passenger be a good passenger and not impede safety on the plane?
Well, the first thing they're going to do is, when they do the safety briefing, you need to pay attention and listen to everything that they're saying. Because, you don't know if you're going to have to use that. Planes have crashed in water. Planes have been disintegrated in water. And everybody died. But a lot of people die because they never pay attention to what the stewardesses or people are saying. Passengers can improve it by being aware of their surroundings. When they give the briefing, where is the nearest exit to you? If there's a crash landing and you're afraid that the plane's going to catch fire, find a coat. And when you put your head between your knees, which is the crash landing position, throw the coat over you. Because if a fire has a flashover when you're in that position, the coat will cushion some of that fire and you might survive. That's something they won't tell you, though. Most of the safety things are about water or the exits. Me personally, and you should do this too, when you walk on a plane, do a 360 look around, see where the exits are. That way you know, if we get in an emergency, I should head to the closest one.
The safest part of the plane be like in the middle?
Okay, well,
that?
Not entirely, because some of the companies, especially Boeing in the past, when they crash land, the plane is actually could snap in half. And that sounds bad, but the sections are meant to break apart. So the front of the plane will break and the other two will snap. Now, if you're in the back of the plane, statistically, you are more likely to survive than anybody else. But that doesn't mean you will. Statistics fail. Computer fail. Calculations fail. You fail. I fail.
Well,
but
how important is your phone, airplane?
Do what?
The bow or the plane mode, how important is that on a plane?
Well, what's the difference of where you sit? Survivability? Preference? A lot of people will sit just in the middle because that's where they want to sit. Safety-wise, I would pick the rear. I personally would never sit in the front because that's going to be the first place that it will snap. And there was a plane in Hawaii where the roof literally snapped off and the entire plane was exposed to the cold winds of the sky, causing emergency descent. And the bolts were holding on by a thread. So that goes back to your manufacturing question. Depends on the company. Boeing is really good because they know how to build a plane and make it last. But the reason that roof snapped off was because a cable was not being maintained. Maintenance is a good key to safety. These companies need to be more strict when it comes to the plane's annual maintenance, which is when they pull the planes aside and they go over for tooth and nail. They check the wings, they take the engines off of the wings and inspect it. Half of the crashes that happen are because of the failure of the maintenance crews.
So in the episode, what are the core principles that people need to take away as a flying or the bomb?
What four principles you can take away that you gave me?
Or what do people take away in Google?
Okay, the most important things in any aerodynamics and everything are, number one, safety is going to be at the top of my list, which is overall important. I'm going to pay attention to, I personally like to listen when I go on planes, the overall sound of the engines, the rattling. I like to look at the structure because I'm interested in that. And that helps in survivability, because if you can feel a plane and understand the plane, you can know if it's doing something it shouldn't. It's just like your body. You can understand your body. Do I have gas? Is it just my stomach turning? Am I getting sick? The plane's no different. Those are principles that you could look at. I like safety. I like structure. Other two principles, I really do not know. Those are the two that I would focus on. And if you like planes, look into the different companies that manufacture them. A lot of them have gone out of business for one reason or the other. But the two key ones that exist today are Boeing and Airbus. Airbus has significantly been proven to be more safer, but that's because they rely heavily on automation.
Yeah.
They are basically making planes to make it look like a computer is doing all the work.
Yeah. I think the major takeaway is, once you understand lifting is important to take off. Weight plays a factor on how you can take off in the first place with the lifting. But the weight being a factor, the drag's a factor, as the more weight you have, the more force you have to slow it down. But the thrusting, you come back the drag, go forward, and also while lifting at the same time plus drag, you have a lift off going against gravity. There's the engine itself. Plus, the force going forward while you're in the sky, keeping you at bay. Yeah,
well, the engine's going to be the main workhorse left to right all the time. And the last thing, a lot of people get scared when they're on a plane because, oh my God, what if we crash? Well, you need to put trust in the flight crew. They didn't get their positions just because they're being paid for it. They actually work their way up. In fact, becoming a captain takes years. You have to have 70,000 hours max to earn your captain stripes. I don't know about you, but if that person has 70,000 flight hours, I think we can trust the person. There's a whole chart that you can look up online of a different amount of flight hours you need to go from a cadet to a personal pilot, commercial pilot, first officer, and captain. The minimum for a first officer is going to be 15,000 to 40,000. Captains have to have three times the amount. So people need to put more trust in the flight crew.
Not only that, but they also need to, you know, put their phone in airplane mode. They always tell you that signals on the, from the cell tower can interfere with the actual operation navigation technology on the plane.
Yeah. And that is second, why they tell you to turn it off during takeoff. Now, once you get to cruising altitude, which is about 2,500, then you can use your phones because you're far away from electronical towers that will interfere. But even then, they're going to ask you to limit it. Now, they don't enforce that with children. So if you're a 12-year-old playing your Game Boy or whatever, they're not really going to ride you about that. But the adults, they don't want the adults on there because cell phones are the most strongest interfering in a cockpit. A lot of people think, oh, that's just a myth. No, it's not a myth. At the right point, it can knock out the entire systems.
And also given the fact that you're in the high altitude, it'll be harder to get that good signal anyway, so keeping your phone in airplane mode might be better. Yeah. You can just use the internet.
You can use your tablet. But you can use your tablet and your laptop, but you have to listen to the flight crew. They will tell you, the stewardesses and stewards will tell you when you can use it. It's about the second strictest thing they enforce besides no alcohol drinks before takeoff.
That's common sense. And drinks can also affect the safety depending on the people can hide explosives in those drinks and liquids. Or let's just say we had an incident with water and liquid. There's a bomb. There's a homemade bomb in it. So TSA is really restrict the amount of liquids on a plane. Before that,
the actuality is, if you're in economy, you cannot get alcohol. That's usually restricted to first class because they're paying more. So, and here's the ironic to first class: they think they're going get more luxury. They actually are, but they're going towards the most unsafest part of the plane if there's a crash, which is going to be right behind the pilots. First class is always in the front. So think about this. You're being moved to a secluded area with maybe about 20 seats. Because first class, they have to pay triple the amount of money. Hundreds and hundreds to get the luxury of their own little pod with a TV and some alcoholic drinks. It's really not worth it. And it hurts you if you crash. But first class is usually where all those snotty people that say, well, I can't use my cell phone. Here's the thing. Economy's treated no differently. If they say
no,
if
I wanted to get rid of you, I'd put you in first class and let you crash.
Well, if the plane crashes, yes, the first class passengers are usually the first affected because they're towards the head, the nose of the plane. The nose of the plane is going to snap off first. In Sussex City, in about, I think it was 1986, a DC-9 had experienced engine problems and diverted to Sussex City. Upon landing, the wing twisted to the left, and it shot the plane across a field on the airport. The plane proceeded to break into three pieces. The cockpit was separated from the rest of the wreckage. They found the cockpit about 3-4 miles away from the wreckage. Miraculously, all four pilots survived. But that's an example of first class towards the front is not always the best thing. I would pick economy. It's cheaper, it's safer, and I don't want to be up front.
That means we can put you with the kid behind you picking your seat, fat man to the left, a sleeping man in the middle, you right in the middle, and then four of you, there's a lady complaining about the plane, and you can be perfect because you won't get any sleep, because the kid kicking you in the front, and the lady's complaining in the back, and the guy right beside you sleeping, well, he's snoring. And the fat guy, well, he's not making you have much room. So
well, personally, if I selected my seat myself, which I would, I wouldn't pick the farthest back in the rear, but I would pick a seat towards that section, knowing if, God forbid, there's a crash, it's gonna snap. Now, that depends on the plane. If I'm on an Airbus, I don't really care because they're a lot more safer. And compared to like a Boeing, is a safe plane. They still actually have DC-9s operational. They still have 737s operational. It's the plane you pick should be dependent on your destination. You're not going to pick a mid-level plane, a smaller one, to go to Japan, because you're going to pick a larger airliner that can actually make that trip. Mid-level planes are kind of like what you call island-hopping planes, used in Hawaii, where they're being run every day throughout the day, taking people to the different islands for work. Because if you're in Hawaii, you're island hopping to get to work because of all the little islands.
Yeah.
Now, if your trip, if you're just going to point A to point B, you're going to want a bigger plane because more leg room, more maneuverability, and you're going to be on a long trip. I doubt yourself, you're really going to want to be in a small plane, cramped together with five other people. You're going to want to have your leg room. That's personally why I don't like the Emirates airline the way they do first class. On that particular company's airplane, they give all first class people their own little pod. It's like a little turtle pod where each individual gets their own little pod. It has a bed, it has a TV, a laptop, but I don't consider that safe.
Boop.
So,
to wrap it up, where can they find your correspondence if they like your commentary with it?
Where can they find you
if they like your correspondence today's episode about flying planes and aerodynamics?
Well, I mean, obviously you're my friend, so you can find me on this phone or my cell number, or I have an email, all of which you have access to do.
So, one last thing. Fly safely. Remember that you true travel, take his advice. You do the law of the plane. Back, wheel, whatever. Follow the instructions, follow the guidance on the plane and airplane mode, yada, yada, yada. But,
right. Also
know, four basic principles, the weather that you're flying in, the machinery that's going in the sky and all the moving parts, and the safety along the way. If you don't know those things, and aerodynamics and the science of flying is not your inclusion.
All right,
guys. Well, this concludes this episode of Science of Flying Aerodynamics. Steven, thank you for being here. It was a pleasure having you. Lots of fun.
All right. Take care.
Bye, guys.
This concludes another episode of MC Anime Podcast. MC Anime Podcast is available on podcast directories like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. We also have our website at mcanimepodcast.com. If you want to directly support us, then follow Patreon blog MC Anime. Finally, if you want services for hire, then we're available on Fiverr for audio and video production, graphic design, idea consulting, and blog and article writing. This concludes another episode of MC Anime Podcast. MC Anime Podcast is available on podcast directories like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. We also have our website at mcanimepodcast.com. If you want to directly support us, then follow Patreon blog MC Anime. Finally, if you want services for hire, then we're available on Fiverr for audio and video production, graphic design, idea consulting, and blog and article writing.